And that jarring cacophony tells you that, yet again, you're back with the Power of Three podcast. It's the 30th of April, if you're listening to this on the day it drops. And today, we're featuring a fourth Doctor book in her ongoing run of novels, featuring each Doctor as we build up to the new series. Today, we're featuring a novel that we had hoped to feature last year in our run, but it was quite hard to get hold of the author, but we've finally tracked him down, and we have got one heck of a cracking interview for you. Yep, we're talking about Managra by Stephen Marley, which was the 14th novel in the Virgin Missing Adventures series, and for those of you who feel the urge to know, it was released on the 21st of September 1995. What on earth were you doing then? I know what I was doing. I was 6 months into my job at Discovery News and having a great time. Obviously, we're back in Virgin Books territory as after a wee trip into BBC Books yesterday with the Sons of Koresh. So let's hear today's back cover blurb. Europe is infested by ghosts, vampires, werewolves, ghouls and other grotesques spawned from old European folklore. I think we're in a spot of bother, Sarah. Europa, designed by lunatics 1,000 years in the future, is a resurrected Europe that lives in an imaginary past. In Europa, historical figures live again. Lord Byron combats Torquemada's Inquisition. Mary Shelley is writing her sequel to Frankenstein, and Cardinal Richelieu schemes to become Pope Supreme, while Aleister Crowley and Faust vie for the post of official Antichrist. When the Doctor and Sarah arrive, they are instantly accused of murdering the Pope. Aided only by a young vampire hunter and a revenant Byron, they confront the sinister theatre of transmogrification in their quest to prove their innocence. Now, before rereading this one, I had memories of it being very theatrical, very clever, very literate, and I was delighted when revisiting it to discover it was all of those things and a lot more. And of course, I'm far better read than I was when I was 21. So there's an awful lot more appreciation. And of course, with characters in this, including Cardinal Richelieu, I couldn't help but picture Peter Capaldi as he appeared in The Three Musketeers. And of course, there's also Casanova, who just so happened to be played by a young David Tennant, as some of you may recall, in what was effectively his Doctor Who edition. So, without further ado, let's meet the author.
Okay, my name's Stephen Marley. I live in England, of Irish parents, I used to muck about when I was very young, so I had rotten jobs until I realised that having rotten jobs is not very good, so I hastened to become an academic, and I was a lecturer for a few years, and that all got a bit strange. It was sociology, which is a weird subject anyway. So after a few years, I left, and I got my first book published via my agent in London, which was a kind of Chinese fantasy, set in ancient China. And very strangely, they asked me to write a book about the Virgin Mary. I did tell them. They asked for a biography. I said, if you want a biography of the Virgin Mary, it was in the back of an envelope, you know. But then, anyway, what I wrote to them was a kind of Carl Jung version of a myth, which is a huge 120,000-word epic about the Virgin Mary. So that was a very strange way to start. But anyway, after that, I did more Chinese fantasy novels, and it winded up very quickly. At a certain point, my agent was asked, do you have anybody who's a bit sort of off the wall? Because we're looking for someone who's kind of might write a kind of bit of a wild ride, Doctor Who novel. So I said, well, okay. I like Doctor Who, absolutely. I'm particularly fond of Tom Baker. So, and that's how I got to write Managra.
Fantastic. Yeah. But of course, before we started, you mentioned that you do have a slightly longer standing family connection with the show through your brother.
That's right. My eldest brother, Tony is older than me, but my God, he bounces about like a boy. It's incredible. I hope that that DNA proper as well for me. Yeah, he's still acting. And he was in one of the very first, I can't remember exactly, I think the very first season, I believe, of Doctor Who, back in, I think it's down to 62 or 63. I should actually remember that, but I think it's 63. And he played a revolutionary guard of the French Revolution. And I think he grabbed hold of the Doctor and went grrr. And that was his performance. Deeply profound performance. Very moving.
Fantastic. So, Managra, it is, before I reread it, before our chat, I always remember this one as being very literate and very, very clever, but also there's some wonderfully dark humour in there as well. Mm-hmm. So would you say that this is, that was a fair summing up, and it's sort of representative of your other work as well?
I think that's a fair summing up of it, yes. Like everything that one does, you can look at it later and say, I could have done this better and that better. That's always going to be true. You can no more write the perfect book than you can run the perfect mile, you know. But all in all, when I, years ago, did look at it again, and there were part, in terms of line-to-line writing, I thought, my God, that's not bad. Well done, younger Steve, you know, younger Stephen. A lot of it surprised. I don't remember writing that. That's okay. So certainly line by line writing, very good. There was one big problem with it, and it's curiously, it's the opposite of some of the people who hustle after the books said, that it goes on too long. In fact, the book is too short for the topics that it covers, for the various plots and interweaving plots of various characters. It's actually too short. And one reviewer who did a very good in-depth view of the book, you know, picked up a few things that were maybe a bit not right. It wasn't any kind of wild praise at all. But he did say the book is clearly too short. many of the characters are skimmed over, and that's true. It is, in a way, close to an epic, actually, that book. I realised that near the end of it when I was writing it. Isn't this a kind of epic? Which wasn't quite what I had in mind to start with. But your summary, I think, is fair enough, yes. It's a book I could still say, yeah, I'm fairly proud of doing that. I'm not ashamed of it at all. I think it's okay. You know,
you should be, because I'd imagine that there's been quite a lot of research involved, given that there's so many historical characters, either from real history or from the history of fiction, and bringing them all together. So, you know, some of the greatest villains or literary villains of our time are just, it's fabulous just being able to enjoy it. Because I know that having reread it now, obviously, I've read an awful lot more than I had when the book came out when I was 21. Yeah. So there's I think I gained an even, you know, a deeper appreciation of it, and, you know, understanding of who these characters are, and perhaps a little bit more of, you know, having lived adult life, more of their motivations as to be why they are.
Yes. I think that's actually true. Well, I say, first of all, the word wild ride was used about, they wanted it pretty wild. And I thought, okay, so I'll do that. And there was, I can't say who said this, but they said, some of the books of Missing Adventures before mine, in some of the places, got a bit preachy. Now, obviously, I'm not going to go for names here, but that's what they thought. So don't be preachy. I said, well, I wasn't going to be preachy. That's not what I do, you know? I'm not a priest. and perhaps not too serious as well. Have, you know, just go wild with it. So, okay. But I knew not to go completely wild. You've got to have some kind of structure, or else it just goes bananas. It's a bit like watching a comedy sketch that goes on too long. You know, okay, you made your point. It's time to stop. So I kept with the structure there. One thing I knew I was going to do beforehand was have a lot of characters, because I thought up this idea of a future time, like a future theme park of Europa. My idea was, maybe this will happen. In other words, what if in 200 or 300 years, life is so easy and everybody's so bloody bored, you know, it's media. What about living in the past for a bit? And I thought, maybe they'll have something like this. But then I went over the top so that they have psionics. That's a wonderful word for having bogus science, isn't it? And other wacky words. So that via science, they can, as it were, create magic and have vampires and werewolves and all that kind of thing. And actually, there are no werewolves actually in the book, but they are referred to. But vampires, yes. Can I tell you now, what I wanted to have in the book, and there just wasn't time or space, was Dracula and Frankenstein. I wanted them both to be there, but there was just no room. So, but I did have a vampire, which we'll talk about later. Perhaps we'll bring it up. And I wanted to put a lot in there, couldn't put it. Once, unfortunate side effect of the length of it, I came in under the word length. You know, I was under the word count, but I think they would only print so many pages. And what they did was to really create a margin so narrow that the inner margin, in other words, sometimes disappeared. That, in other words, when you've got a margin of 2 centimeters or more, the outer margin, the inner margin is not there, and it's very hard to read a book. In fact, it's a great way of breaking the spine of any book is to read Menagra, because of the way it's set up. Now, that's unfortunate, because it did affect, you know what I mean, don't you?
Yes.
It did affect a lot of people's reading. I was a bit unhappy about that. So you should have really just cut down the outer margin. It solved all the problems. But they said it wasn't our fault, and it wasn't the fault of the publisher I was talking to, actually. It was sent out. But that was a side effect of the length of it. But I think books have said enough about that for the time being, anyway.
No, I thought it was great getting to meet all these different characters, and particularly the fact we've got 3 iterations of Byron with the Mad, Bad, and Dangerous.
Yes,
and the fact that you get them fighting and meeting, and one kills another is very, very dark. There's almost like an element of suicide to it, but not. And there's sort of the one-upmanship between them is rather tasty.
I think it was Lady Caroline Lamb who called it Mad, Bad, and Dangerous to know. Mm-hmm. Lady Caroline Lamb, she had an affair with him. Her husband wasn't very happy about. And
yeah. Being able to sort of bring these characters, and as you mentioned, we may not have got Frankenstein, but we've got Mary Shelley in there, so we've got the next best thing. But I think that's the thing, that it's sort of can tell that you've got a real love of literature and of horror films. I mean, there's moments where it felt, I can visualise this as a Hammer horror film.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's meant as an absolute compliment, because I love Hammer horror films.
Yes, I am. And in fact, many years later, myself and my partner, she said, why don't you try this? And I thought, I will try this. We went in contact with Hammer Films, and they hadn't done any films for ages. And when we went to see Hammer Films, we went inside a building. There was a little door with a piece of paper on it, with lines on it, and written in biro, Hammer Films. Hammer Films, of course. And we talked to the guy, I can't say too much, but there was no interest in bringing back the Hammer horror, you know. And I said, there really is a demand for this gothic. And after all, Bram Stoker's Dracula, Pansies for Coppola, something of the tradition of Hammer, a lot of it, did extremely well. And to this day, people love it. I think that was a pity that Hammer never really picked up on that Hammer horror tradition. I actually wrote a short story with Miles Dashwood in it, a short story. The Doctor wasn't in it, and no problem about copyright on this one. But I had Frankenstein and Dracula in that particular one. And there's that throughout it, you keep coming across Hammers. Anyway, I won't go anymore. Give away some of the jokes in it. But it's in the tradition of Menagra, that short story.
Yeah, and I'll ask you where people can find out later. You mentioned there Miles Dashwood, and just what a creation is. You can just imagine him as being an Errol Flynn sort of, the dashing buccaneer, the brave hero, the one who's absolutely just, the perfect film star. And I think I take it that was where your inspiration for him came from, that sort of perfect creation, the one who's ideal for fighting these bad guys.
Well, one thing is, it's very important as a writer is not to over-describe your main character, because you need to have each reader injecting what they want them to look like and what they like, and it's very important. So I never over-described him. Mind you, I did come as blonde, So that wouldn't normally fit with Aeroflin, but if, I could tell you what its spaceship was. There was a Hammer film called Captain Kronos Vampire Hunter. Do you remember
another one? Yes.
There was a really good-looking German actor. I can't remember his name now, but blonde. It was somewhat based on him, but even better looking than him, and 20 years old. So, and flamboyant. And there was also something outside of Hammer. I do refer to Michael York in the book, and that was because, to a certain extent, he Miles Dashwood has got this awful snobbery that Michael York has D'Artagnan. Because he said, no, that's what, you're just a servant all the time. It's absolutely, it's in a funny way because the films are so well made. But that's an element as well. There's a touch of Michael York about it too. Yeah. The young Michael York, of course.
Absolutely. Yeah. So how did you find capturing Tom Baker and Liz Sladen's performances in print? I'd imagine that you'd watched back in the day, a good old few VHS tapes just to get their voices back in the head.
Yeah, absolutely. I think because Tom Baker, I mean, everybody's got to have their own favourite doctor, but a lot of people will say Tom Baker is a favourite or co-favourite with David Tennant. For me, it's Tom Baker and David Tennant. I can't choose between them. They're just me. But with Tom Baker, of course, David Tennant had not come yet this time. But with Tom Baker, he's such a vivid character. The man himself, in fact, it almost, you're looking at Tom Baker when you're looking at the Doctor, aren't you, really? He is like that. And for the very first time I saw him, when he's tried on new clothes, the very first appearance as a Doctor, and he comes out as a very depressed Viking with huge horns. Thought, this is going to be a very interesting guy. And a clown. I think he came as a clown as well. Was it Pagliacci?
Yeah.
So he was such a vivid character. And that voice, he had a really sonorous, excellent voice, and that takes you a long way, because if you can hear that actual voice itself, regardless of what they're saying, it makes it much easier to write the words for them. So I didn't nick anything off the screen as such, and I won't say he said this kind of thing or he said that kind of thing. I didn't do that. I imagine all my books being like in a film. I'm in a film and I'm sort of it's a part of that and dreaming at the same time. It's something like that. So I was kind of interacting with him. He was saying something to me, and often he'd actually say something to me. I wouldn't be aware that I actually wrote it was my idea. Sometimes people speak for themselves if you get in the right, if you're aware of the actual situation. So when it came to writing his stuff, it almost as if he wrote his own lines. And I decided that he should be. I was also aware that he couldn't be himself, and Sarah couldn't be in the novel as much as in the usual novels, because there were so many other characters, this whole world had a world building to involve. So I had to bring him across in quite a few scenes. And I also decided to make him a little mysterious. That is, Sarah at no point would say he's this kind of person. The way she would react would be something like, he's like an uncle to me, compared to the previous Doctor, who's like a father. I thought that was a fair thing to say, actually.
Yes.
People. But like an uncle, but she can't quite fathom him, really. She's all the time trying to work him out. So I wanted an air of mystery about him. Yeah. So, but a lot of the time, it's just a sort of comical. He uses techno babble kind of with a tongue-in-cheek, you know?
Yeah.
I thought it was. Maybe others will disagree.
No, I think it's fantastic. And I think particularly, I got the impression that you particularly enjoyed writing the vampire stuff. I think that came across as and vampires with a difference as well. The fact we're getting the shades, it's not just straightforward, I want to drink your blood. There's actually a bit more to them there in this new Europa.
Oh yeah, they have their own hierarchy. I think they use the word Ipsissimus, the top ones. But they also had detachable shadows. I was quite pleased with the detachable shadow.
Yes, that's scary.
Yeah, that's why we have a lot of fun with it. You see, so much there, as I was writing, I thought, I wish I could do more with this all the time. But I had to move on constantly. Yeah, and of course, Byron, I think Is it? I think it's Mad Byron that's the vampire.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I should have known that instantly. Yeah, he is a vampire. And of course, there's we'll have to talk about vampires. Well, it's about Miles Dashwood, the vampire hunter. But, well, he's the... Well, we'll call him, he's the ultimate stereotype of the dashing young hero, you know. And he thinks the word dash, he uses it, calls himself Miles Dashing, so nobody will know who he really is. I guess it's Miles Dashwood.
it's very cunning.
When I had Miles, I thought, God, you've got it, Stephen. Dashing. To call himself that, that fits on all sorts of levels, the dashing young hero. So I was quite happy with that. Yeah, and he's incredibly snobbish. But I find him likable. I don't. One normally is not going to like very snobbish people, but I suppose he's so over the top with it that it's quite funny. And his servant Crocker is always getting the better of him. And Miles Dashwood is never quite aware of it, like where the money keeps going. Mm-hmm. For example, those vampires. I had great fun with them. I thought, how's he? It popped into my head. I don't know how, but it just popped into my head. I'd like to have a shootout with state guns. I thought, why don't they have state guns? Yeah. I mean, Buffy, Vampire Slayer, you know, state guns, mm-hmm. Save you a lot of trouble. You know? Great series, by the way. I love Buffy. And I had this tolling bell. So when the I had to quick on the draw with the state gun. And I thought the vampire having a state gun, I thought it was all great fun. I just loved all of that. Yeah.
And talking of, we've mentioned Dashing there as the hero. And then, of course, we've got the villain of the piece with Francis Pearson or Dr. Sperano. But of course, you've laid some nice little traps there, because when he's being referred to as the master with a capital M in places, and we're thinking, oh, we can see what's going on here. And of course, completely wrong footed. And you must have enjoyed putting that in just to give us just to fool us all, really.
I think I mentioned the Medals of Monk once as well. I may be wrong about that.
Yeah, there's a reference to the monk in there too.
I was very mischievous looking back at it.
I suppose that must have been good fun for you as well, sort of just making us think that. And I suppose that's the thing, is the power of the writer being able to lead us up alleyways that aren't actually where we think they're going.
My guess was that the reader will look at that and say, maybe, we'll see. Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah, it definitely fooled me. And I suppose writing, you're creating your own villain of the piece in Francis Pearson, who's a frustrated contemporary of Shakespeare who never got the glory and the credit. And I suppose that's the thing. Writers always enjoy writing about other writers, from what I've discovered from interviews over the years, and particularly those who've, particularly making them bad guys.
Oh, that's true. I suppose you can see into their minds quite well. But the whole point about Francis Pearson is probably the worst writer in history. And it did occur to me, I have to say, my eldest brother's an actor, and a lifelong close friend of his is Derek Jacobi, who played Claudius in our Claudius. He's almost given up acting now because of his age. But I have the idea of writing a play called A Good Play and calling it Francis Pearson, written by me, and writing the worst play in history, absolutely diabolically bad, but a play called A Good Play, because and obviously I was trying to make it hilariously funny at the same time. I mean, and I did say pass it on to Derek about this, because if there are any kind of reviews, the reviews would have to include the word A Good Play. So they can't get away with that one, you know. They'll catch them out no matter what. But anyway, I was thinking of becoming briefly Francis Pearson, trying to write the worst play ever written. And the most, you know, people introduce themselves to each other, describing their surroundings. People should know, they all, you know, I who am your butler, as you know, that all cut the hand. What's mentioned of his plays in the novel are quite a lot of that kind of references.
It must have been great fun, you know, doing that sort of iambic pentameter, like persona non grata in realms high and low. I pull the heartstrings of puppet, friend, and foe. Come 12 and 1, the play will show I am the author of all your woe. It's almost like primary school poetry in some of it. And you must have had so much fun doing that.
Yes. I was quite pleased with that one, because it almost carries off a decent bit of poetry. Almost. It's not quite there. Yes, that's right. Yes. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I think that really came across. There's a lot of joy in the book, and it's as I said earlier on, very darkly humorous, you know, with all the masks and things being involved, and masks that actually change people's physical form and things like that, and then their personality is taken over. In many ways, it is like actors being consumed by the part. I suppose like Tom Baker began to think he was the Doctor and became interseparate. They just couldn't separate the two of them. Which I think was a nice touch.
The novel is supposed to be a fun novel. Definitely, it's supposed to be a fun novel. Now, there's a dark stuff in there too, but you could imagine if you're creating a thing, you're not going to get particularly scared because you know the nuts and bolts. You know where it all came from. you know the design.
Yeah.
You know the timing and everything. Now, a reader has something of a different experience, but essentially, to me, it was a fun kind of thing. There were so many in-jokes that I put in there, and also literary references are all over the place. The Pit and the Pendulum, Edgar Allan Poe. I have a Pit and a Pendulum, because I saw the Roger Corman film, Pit and the Pendulum, which I thought was pretty good, actually. They're not all great, the Roger Corman ones, but that Pit and the Pendulum is pretty good. And another one of his is Follow the House of Usher. While I had the Villa Diodati, in which that's the real-life villa in which Byron and his friends, including Mary Shelley, all wrote a horror story, and that's where she started to write Frankenstein. I think that's quite a famous kind of thing. And I think he's the 16-year-old doctor. Mm-hmm. 17-year-old Byron wrote a vampire story, Varney the Vampire. But it was based upon Byron. So in a sense, Dracula and Frankenstein started that Villa Diodati. Well, the Villa Diodati in a more dramatic form is in the book. But at the end of it sinks, just like the fall of the House of Usher. It sinks, yeah, and there's a reference there. They're all over the place, these references. So we're there for someone to enjoy. Oh, well, people enjoy finding things. It's like getting a joke.
Well, I definitely got the Pit and the Pendulum when Byron's riding it as it goes even there.
Oh, that's right. But I can think of a joke. This is a joke sort of at the top of my head. Figure of death. Death comes to the knight and says, I've come for you. The knight says, I hear you play chess. Death says, no. Now, that's quite a weak joke, but make it worse. What makes it worse is when you tell them, the knight says, I hear you play chess, and death says, no. It completely flat in the second one. So you have to just, that's not a very good example. You know what I mean? People have to, for a joke to work, it works best when people work it out themselves, and then it's laid out. So there's a lot in the novel which is asking the reader to figure something out. And I noticed the people who liked it best, or some of the people hated the novel, the ones who liked it best particularly refer to all these little things that are amusing along the way. Because when you figure something out, it's more pleasurable than the writer is telling you. Show, not tell. In other words.
I mean, there's things in there that I'd completely forgotten about. You know, things like, here we are, page 124. I made a note of this, Countess Elizabeth Bathory, Lady Incarnadine, which thought, what? And of course, became the inspiration for Countess Dracula. And that's an amazing, I knew that Ingrid years ago. And I didn't realize actually that the thing that was based on and something true. So I had a good wee Google, and I spent a good 20 minutes just reading all about her, and fascinating text. So thank you for expanding my knowledge. That's a good thing. Doctor Who's original, part of its original mandate was to try and to inform, educate and entertain. So you ticked all three boxes.
And I had the great honour of chatting to Ingrid Pitt. She came here to Derby, that's where I live, Derby, and to show two of her films at the Art College. And afterwards, she recognised her a little bit. We met briefly, but didn't have a chat. And anyway, this time we had a proper talk. She talked a lot about Elizabeth Bathory and how she talked about him to Christopher Lee. And Christopher Lee talked a lot about the whole thing. And he wished he'd been in the film and all kinds of stuff. Yeah, but Ingrid Pitt, I've played her very well. Also in a very good film about lesbian vampire lovers.
Oh, yes, The Vampire Lovers. Yeah, I remember that one quite well from my teenage years, especially. Yeah,
great film, actually, great film.
Yes, very good. And Twins of Evil, I enjoyed that too. But, of course, we get Sarah becoming possessed and becoming Lady Tangerine. And of course, you've got this beautiful cover by Paul Campbell for the book.
Yeah.
And sort of that the orange is there coming across, and it perfect, absolutely perfect.
Absolutely captured Tom Baker's face there. That's absolutely Tom Baker. Perfect.
Yeah. So you mentioned a minute ago there that a mixed reception, because when we were emailing, you said that you'd had some negative responses. So I'm going to give you some positive ones from 2024 when I put on Twitter that I was reading this book. Chris Orton said, good choice. Neil Matthews said, one of my favourites. It could easily have been a Hinchcliffe Holmes TV story. And the key line, heat's not a furnace for your foe so hot that it do singe yourself, explains perfectly how the Doctor so often turns his enemy strengths against themselves. The terrible Zoden said, will be interesting to read it again, and mentally cast David Tennant as Casanova and Peter Capaldi as Richelieu, which of course roles they've since played, and that's exactly how I envisaged them when reading this. Jay Fitzoliver said it's a good one. John Lane said, I really like this one. And Mestor and the Magnificent said, love this one. Top tier missing adventure. So there you go, Stephen. Your book is still held in very high esteem, particularly by people who enjoy the books. And these people are all sort of keen missing adventures, new adventures fans. So I think I can say on behalf of all of them and myself, thank you for creating such a great read.
Well, thank you. I think, from what I remember, the reactions were either very positive or very negative. Very few in between. Now, the positive ones, we've gone over all that kind of thing, that they liked all the things we were talking about, so that's straightforward. The negative ones, well, there's one a very long, long review, and almost half of it was about what Sarah Jane was wearing a bikini. It was about the bikini. And she said, I'm a male chauvinist, and I get sexual satisfaction, blah, 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 blah. In fact, the only reason I put it in a bikini was because of the actual Vatican's rules about women must not come in, into the Vatican with bare arms, or skin must, flesh must not be visible above the knee. So I thought, right, well, it was really two fingers to the Vatican rules, actually. Mm. That's why I did a bikini. I just thought it was hilarious. I originally meant all of the cardinals to always pass out with horror, you know, but it didn't quite work out with the words. But that was the reason. So people often misunderstand or can read motives in that aren't there. I'll tell you one very strange one I got a year ago. It was an email, and someone said, I came close to what he said. He said, I'm an atheist, but I'm going to cancel everything you do, and I'm quite powerful. He said, because you've attacked the Catholic Church, I'm going to defend the Catholic Church from your religious hatred. Well, it so happens I'm a Catholic, actually. And I thought, that's a strange world in which an atheist is going to defend the Catholic Church. I'm a Catholic, a bit of an agnostic one, yeah, but, you know, I like all the... I like all the architecture and the, you know, all that kind of stuff. And there's some very strange things there. I noticed it's kind of died off, the hate mail, because we used to get quite a lot of that hate mail for the book. A few others. I wrote a book called The Heresy, which is about, starts off with the death of the Pope of John Paul I, who only reigned for about 33 days. Mm-hmm. So that's one.
The Liz Truss of Popes.
Right, yeah. Yes. And also, by the way, John Paul I, the rumour that he was murdered also is in, of course, the beginning of Menagra. It's, again, a murder. And I think at one point someone tried to pass it off as suicide. Spear right through it. Oh, I wondered a bit there. Yeah, but I mean, one unhealthy thing has happened. I won't go on anymore about this because it's not really the place for it. But there's a great danger when politics becomes a religion for people. When that happens, everybody who doesn't think as you do is the enemy, and you don't even talk to them. Elements of that has come into criticism of some novels, not just mine, obviously, other people's. And it'd be healthy if just people try to maybe move away from that a bit, you know. Don't assume everybody who doesn't think issue is evil. Good chance they're not. Yeah.
You only did the one Doctor Who novel. Did you ever have thoughts about doing another?
There was one I set up to do about Elizabeth Báthory. It was going to be a prequel with the Doctor and that. But the... that's right. They say, well, just hang on for a bit. And just as about to start it, the BBC took back the rights to Swerger. I think it was about 18 months after my novel came out that they took the rights back. So there was a fair pause, but the certain writers who were well established, you know, wanted to get their stuff in, and I didn't mind waiting. You know, I wrote another novel in the meantime anyway, you know, so not a problem. So that's the reason. I had one ready called about Elizabeth Báthory. It would have been darker than this one, actually. So not quite sure how I'll go about that, because the things she's reputed to have done are quite horrific.
As I've discovered from my reading, yes.
Yeah. Well, some people think it was all made up. They should have done any of those things, but who knows?
Well, that's the joy of fiction. You can actually make these things happen. So, Stephen, tell us about your other work. You've mentioned, obviously, other novels and things that you've done. So, well, tell us about some of your other books and where people can find out more about your writing.
Well, there was that very strange one I said about the Virgin Mary. I said to they said, we desperately have to have this done really quickly. It's got to be 120,000 words. It's got to be done in less than 2 months, blah, blah, blah. But here's the money for it. And at that time, I couldn't actually pay my mortgage. I thought, okay. But I said, it can't be a biography. Say this. Just say it's fiction. I said, we'll do that. They didn't board it out as biography. But what I tried to do with it was to say, I repeat, I was writing fiction. And if you take sort of Carl Jung, and not everybody's familiar with Carl Jung, I know that, but some people will be. He looked at the idea of archetypes and myth as forms of truth. In other words, all the great fairy tales have a certain truth inside them. So there's a big difference between truth and fact. Or you certainly can distinguish between the two things. To give one example, there's something I've actually just written. I'm writing a book about Joseph Wright. Now, he was you know the painter, do you? The painter Joseph Wright?
Yep.
Yeah. There's never been a novel about him. And he lived just about 100 yards from where I live. He died in the house. It's always makes sense in a moment. And he lived about 150 yards away from the very first factory in the world where the Industrial Revolution started in 1721, called Rome Silk Road. So where the Industrial Revolution started is just right beside where he lived. And he did what is a famous painting, everybody will know it by sight, of a bird in an air pump and a slightly mad-looking scientist. And it's got this, it's a thing called tenebrous, intense darkness, intense light. And in that, he was prophesying where the Industrial Revolution will be, both light and dark. So that is a crucial painting. And one of the things I've done as a joke within that is I've referred, jumped forward in time to William Blake. I've had William Blake on horseback with a saucepan on his head and bits of fake metal like armour, holding a jousting lance, and he's on a railway line and is charging forward towards an oncoming train. Now, if you know a bit about William Blake, you know that's a very good summary of William Blake's view of the world, his take on the modern world. Now, of course, so there's a truth about that, William Blake, but fact, of course, it's not fact, it's wacky. It's a bit like what I think is an underrated film of Ken Russell called The Music Lovers, about Tchaikovsky.
I don't know that one.
That one, I think, is so underrated. The Women in Love, that people know about that one, but I think that's quite a slow, kind of poorly paced film myself. But when I saw The Music Lovers, and a lot of people I know who watched it say, wow, this is amazing. But after that, he got a bit wacky, you know, deliberately became extreme. But that one, let's say about Tchaikovsky, The Music Lovers, is incredible. And that uses a lot of the kind of example I gave of William Blake, very extreme things happening on the screen, which are true to the character of Tchaikovsky, but never actually happened.
I'm just thinking I'm going to go and try and find this now. So that's a wee mission for this evening.
Well, like it says, or you could put us on clips on YouTube if you want to have a quick gander at the beginning of it. Yeah. So I tried to write a mythic epic about the Virgin Mary, but try to take it seriously. In other words, what did she represent? And I discovered some interesting things. I discovered, for example, that the Hebrew God, Yahweh, Jehovah, whatever you want to call him, originally had a wife called Asherah. And that the name can mean many things. It can mean Lady of the Sea, Queen of Heaven. But it can also mean the Lady of the Tree of Life. And as soon as I got into this, I thought, this is very interesting. I can only go so much, but my point is this. If you're looking at myths, you look at the myth of the Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden has a tree at the center of it called the Tree of Life. I thought, is this a coincidence? And the other tree is called the Tree of Knowledge. And I knew that there was one of the few extant writings of the heretic called Simon Magus, who's rather something of a villain in history. He is a contemporary of Jesus and St. Peter. Well, what little is left of his writings, he says, consider the Garden of Eden, a paradise, to be the womb, and birth to be the fall. And so, again, that's an interesting way of looking at things. In other words, what's behind mythology? And then I thought, Tree of Life, we've got Asherah. Have we got, is there something behind what was these early biblical tales that we've lost a long time ago? And maybe you get the idea of how I approached this Virgin Mary fictional life. I was trying to find something between ancient myths and bring them forward. By the way, I'm rewriting the whole novel, and I've got to do it really properly because I had to rush it out very quickly before. Now I'm calling it Mary Messiah. It's going to cause a lot. I've even got a young Jesus telling you, well, no, I won't tell you what it is. So young Jesus has to learn, you know?
Yeah.
And for example, when he's 16, he sees some really attractive girls at a kind of hippie camp. He quite fancies them, you know? And she's behaved herself, all kinds of stuff. So I'll give me a lot of trouble with it, but I'm going to go ahead anyway. Anyway, I really went on too long about that. I apologize. Oh,
not at all. Fascinating. Always interesting. I love hearing about creative processes, things. So you've written a fair bit over the years. So where does Menagra fit in? Is it something that, when you did mention that you still like it, and is it something that you're still proud of and think, yeah, that's one of my best?
Yes, absolutely. I think I said a while ago that, yeah, I'm proud of it. And as I said, writing line by line, look at that line by line, that's the stuff you forget. You know, it's happened so many years ago, you know.
Yeah.
So you don't remember line by line or little jokes you put in, that kind of thing. So you can actually say, oh, well done, without any ego. It's like somebody else has done these. You think it takes you by surprise. I'm proud of the book. Of course I could see things I could do better, obviously. But yeah, I'm proud of it. And in the circumstances, the little time I had to do it wasn't very long. I think I did okay.
Yeah, I think okay is an understatement. I think, yeah. But one final question. You mentioned that you'd written a further adventure for Miles Dashing Dashwood. It's a short story. Is that available to be found elsewhere?
I'm going to bring that out. What I've done recently is I've been looking into how books are sold, and after trying a few publishers that didn't do a very good job, in other words, for a book called The Heresy, which is a pretty decent Vatican thriller, actually, I think, a publisher took it up. In the space of a year and a half, it sold 19 copies. 19. Publishing house closed down. When it closed down, I had the full rights, came back to me. So I thought, I'm going to just publish it straight under Amazon, you know, Kindle, direct publishing. 3 months after I did that, I was one above Stephen King, briefly. Now, whether you like Stephen King or not, you all know he's awesome. You managed to get one above him, my God. It was in the thriller section. So I was number six thrillers in the world of all types of thrillers. That's just doing them. I designed the cover myself, did it all for free, just took it online. No advertisements. All I did was to put a cheap price on it, on the ebook. So why I say all this is that I've decided, I've learned my lesson. I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but I'll say it anyway. I'm beginning to think the publishers are dinosaurs. A lot of them are telling people what you should write, for a start. They're highly political now, many of them. And that, I believe in freedom of speech, whatever, including people who don't agree with me, you know, or perhaps especially so. So I do. I'm now going to publish directly. There's a reason I'm answering this. When my next novel comes out, it'll probably be the Mary Messiah, the totally rewritten one, which I do think is an impressive book. I've got to say this. I'm looking at it now as I'm writing it. My God, you've got something here. You really have. And when that comes out, I'm going to publish novellas with it. And one of those, some of those novellas, at least two of them, will be Miles Dashwood. One of them is Dracula versus Frankenstein. I've got to tell you what the first line is. Now, of that, it says, it was the best of first lines. It was the worst of first lines.
That's Tale of Two Monsters there. Yeah,
That's not bad. I hasten to tell you, it very quickly becomes obvious he's playing chess with Frankenstein. The first line is actually a line of pawns. He thinks it was right anyway, but then it leads into it. But I couldn't resist that. I thought, yes, I can't resist putting that in as the first one. Thank you, Charles Dickens.
Fantastic. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for your time. It has been an absolute joy to chat, and thank you for sharing all these memories of Managra and beyond.
Well, likewise, I really enjoyed talking to you and I really appreciate it.
Huge thanks to Stephen for his time, and I hope you enjoyed that, because I certainly did. One of the more enjoyable interviews I've done. They're all enjoyable, but that one was a little bit extra. So, as we're doing throughout this series, we're having a quick look to see what the reviews said at the time. So we're having a look in the pages of Doctor Who magazine, issue 230, and the reviewer is now Dave Owen. He says, "The mood throughout is inevitably rather dark. Even the Doctor is more subdued than his television counterpart, rarely joking, and communicating mostly in quotes from Shakespeare. Sarah dwells on her previously untold unhappy childhood. The imaginative breadth of this novel reminded me of Sky Pirates, although the sheer quality of storytelling far exceeds that of the latter. The tongue-in-cheek humour arises naturally, rather than appearing as a sequence of jokes to be included. I found myself visualising Managra as a Terry Gilliam film, like The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, although it belongs quite firmly on the printed page. Many of the story's twists and turns are dependent upon words, anagrams and quotations, and the Doctor's vocabulary goes well beyond its television range, including such archaic gems as widdershins. Although I previously knew very little about the historical characters depicted, Stephen subtly weaves in their backgrounds. There are also original protagonists. I was drawn to Miles Dashwood, an air-headed swashbuckler, and his shrewd servant, Crocker, who has to feign ignorance to retain menial employment. There's an eclectic mixture of genres. Transylvanian vampires mingle with power-hungry cardinals, and the story combines suspense, horror, and mystery. Much of the pleasure comes from guessing just how Europa came to be and who the villain really is, the Doctor becoming characteristically unforthcoming in his suspicions. Managra could have featured the Doctor and Sarah a little more, but it's an experiment in literary grandiosity that works perfectly." So there we go. Dave liked it. I have to agree. I did enjoy it. I thought it was a great book, very literate, very clever, and I enjoyed it far more this time around than I did on my first reading, when I did enjoy it, but you just gain a bit of a deeper impression with a few more years of life experience under the belt. So thoroughly enjoyed it and cannot recommend it enough. So that's us at the end of another episode, another day. I'll be back tomorrow with a Fifth Doctor novel. It's a virgin book, but which one? There's only one way to find out. Be here. But as ever, we like to play out with a song. So today we're going to play out with one which you may remember from 1989. I have to admit, I did have to Google this one because I had a vague memory of it. But yes, here it is. It's a song from Rush, and it's called, appropriately enough, Anagram, which just so happens to be an anagram of Managra. Isn't that a coincidence?
There's a snake coming out of the darkness, parade from paradise, and the need for reading, chase the dreams of merchandise.